I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Philadelphia is one of several cities that have passed laws requiring single-stall public restrooms be gender-neutral. While those facilities are open to everyone, the bill will help transgender and gender non-conforming people who can face harassment and feel anxious about using a men's room or a women's room. The mayor's Office of LGBT Affairs has an interactive Google app that helps people find gender-neutral bathrooms. You can go to the Gotta Go Guide. The director of the office, Helen Fitzpatrick, is with us here in our Philadelphia studio. I should add that voters last week made the LGBT office permanent part of the mayor's administration, and she joins us on Radio Times. Helen Fitzpatrick, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let's start with what City Council did and how have things changed in Philadelphia when it comes to single-stall bathrooms.
Right. Well, in effect, what will happen is that you'll just see the signs that say men or women or those markers that look like that white stick figure with a dress or without a dress come down, and you'll see these spaces labeled as what they are, bathrooms, restrooms, or toilets. That is all. It's really a simple sign change that has a profound impact on certain individuals in our city. It lessens anxiety and dangers for them.
So nothing that says neutral, no adjectives, just basically the word bathroom?
Correct. That's all they are, bathrooms.
Well, that's interesting because one of the articles that I read in preparation for the show are the kind of mental gymnastics that people are going through about what do we call these places? And you're saying bathroom.
Bathrooms. You know, when you ask where the restroom is, you're asking where the restroom is, not where is the gender segregated space that I can go into and do whatever it is I need to do. You know, there's a lot of talk and a lot of things being published about how on earth will we label these places now that this space for one person to go in at a time with a toilet and a sink is now open to everybody. What will we do? So you see people talking about how they, you know, do we call them gender neutral or do we call them all gender facilities? Do we include signage that has all of the little signs? Do we make a statement saying that all genders can come in here? I think it's pretty implied. If you label it as a bathroom and don't limit it at all, people know what to do. They know how to go to the bathroom.
And we are talking about bathrooms in this hour of Radio Times. It's actually more important than I think many people think, especially when it comes to things like civil rights. But let's say I own a restaurant and I have a men's room and a women's room. What's going to happen to me?
Well, it'll depend on the type of men's or women's room that you have. If you have two facilities and inside of those are multiple stalls where multiple people could be using multiple toilets, those signs will still stay up. Those will still be labeled as men's rooms or women's rooms. But if you have a bathroom where you open the door and there's just a toilet and a sink, maybe one of the facilities has a toilet urinal and sink, and maybe the other one has a toilet baby changing station and sink, you will have to take down the signs that say men and women, and you will need to put up a sign that says bathroom, restroom, or toilet. You won't need to take the urinal out of the one, and you won't need to take the baby changing table out of the other, but we certainly know that not just women need to change babies, and we certainly know that women can, you know, people can use toilets with a urinal just sitting there. There's certainly no limitation. A toilet doesn't work if there's a urinal in the room, so.
Well, and it seems this opens this up not just for transgender people or gender identity people or however we want to describe it. It really opens it up to everybody, to all of us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I can tell you, you know, as a cisgender female, how many times have I stood in a line for the women's room while I'm looking at a no line for the, quote,
men's room?
Been
there, done that. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, when we're talking about just two spaces that are exactly the same, use whatever one is available. And I have a lot of people that say to me, oh, well, I do that anyway. You know, I'll just go into whatever one is available. Well, good for you. You know, you feel confident in doing that. Not everybody walks in your shoes and has that level of security or safety. You know, a lot of people face not just stress or anxiety in using these spaces, but true danger. And that's because of what other people do to them. It's gender policing in a sense. It's other patrons looking at somebody and saying, you know what? I don't think that you should be going in there. And therefore, I'm going to do something about it. Whether it's a dirty look, a comment, calling the police, following you into the street, or assaulting you, you know, it can really rise significantly in danger.
You're talking about how some transgender people feel using a sex-specific bathroom and how they can be treated there?
Sure, that's exactly what I'm talking about. for instance, a story that I shared with City Council during the hearing and that many people are aware of throughout our nation is the story of Chrissy Paulus. Chrissy was a 22-year-old, this was back in 2011, so she was 22 when this happened, a trans-identified woman who on April 18th went into a women's room in a McDonald's just outside of Baltimore. And she was assaulted by two young women for going into that space. She was repeatedly punched and kicked and beaten to the ground. Chrissy was pulled through the restaurant by her hair while being brutalized. And the reason that we know about this particular incident is because one of the employees at McDonald's, instead of calling 911 or trying to stop this brutal attack, pulled out a phone and started videotaping it. Mm-hmm. The video, when it finally cuts off, Chrissy is in a fetal position, appearing to be having a seizure, bleeding from the face by a trash can. And the individual taking the video was telling everybody to run because the cops are probably going to come. That video,
horrifying.
It is. It was uploaded to YouTube and some other sources by the person that took it, and it went viral. And after that happened, Chrissy said that she never would have told anybody what happened, that she was so traumatized and also so embarrassed that she never would have even told the police. So for all of the people like Chrissy out there who have experienced, if not just harassment, serious violence, who are afraid to say anything or do anything, let's just give them bathrooms to use. That's all this is. Let's just take away the license for some people to harass them.
Do you see this? You're a lawyer. Do you see this as a civil rights issue?
Absolutely.
The right to use a bathroom?
Absolutely. And it has been looking back through time.
Talk to us a bit about this interactive Google app that is called the Gotta Go Guide. How
sure.
does that work?
So it's an interactive Google map that we essentially built out because the 2013 LGBT rights bill here in Philadelphia included one particular thing that was really important, and that was that all newly constructed or newly renovated city buildings would have a gender neutral bathroom, a bathroom open to everybody. Well, this is Philadelphia. We haven't built that many new city buildings, and we certainly haven't been renovating them. We have a lot of other things to do with our dollars, and that's just not where they're going. So while wonderful in meaning, the impact wasn't there. So I wanted to find a way to make sure that people who are going out into our city can access the spaces they need. Williams Institute study showed that 58% of trans-identified individuals actually refrain from going into public due to anxiety about simply using a bathroom.
Meaning they don't go out to the movies or out to dinner?
Right. They're not going out into public just because they're worried about whether or not they can go. 54% report having physical complications, kidney infections, bladder infections, and so on from not going. So, I mean, everybody's got to go. So it seemed really simple. Let's build this out so that it's Philadelphia specific, and let's give people the options to send in bathrooms so that we can provide a little bit more information. You know, when you go into this particular Starbucks, to the back of the restaurant on the right, you're going to find two single occupancy bathrooms that are labeled for everybody to use. They can also put negative experiences. You know, you went into this space and you know, the bar owner maybe looked at you funny and you didn't feel safe. So it really was just a tool to help open this up until we could do something like Bill 150668, which is the bill that we're here talking about. That was we're very grateful that it was sponsored by Councilman Squilla, and that it went flying through City Council with a completely unanimous vote. So that will hopefully make it so that that Google map should blow up. I'll be doing a lot of typing in a Google Maps, so
keep you very busy.
Yeah.
Is this something that other cities have done? Is this something that you looked at with other cities about finding, gender neutral bathrooms?
Yes, there are other apps out there. I believe there's one called Refuge and a couple other things like that cover certain cities that actually cover wide spaces. But we thought that it would be really good to have one that is Philadelphia specific, mm-hmm. and that individuals can have control over, that they can say what they're seeing, they can say what they're liking, they can say the problems they're having by submitting bathrooms. So you can submit a bathroom through the website for the Office of LGBT Affairs, which is lgbtphilly.wordpress.com. You'll see the link there for the Gotta Go Guide, and whether or not you're on your smartphone or a computer, you can pull it up and check it out.
Did you ever think, since becoming director of this office, that you'd be spending so much time on bathrooms?
I never did. No, I didn't realize that bathrooms would be such a permanent part of my day. It's not, you know, not many of us spend a lot of time talking about bathrooms in our daily lives. It's certainly not really a normal topic of a conversation. And especially when you're talking about public bathrooms, not many people think of real positive memories about a public bathroom. You know, it's certainly strange, but it definitely is something that is absolutely crucial, you know, to many people in our city.
This Office of LGBT Affairs voted last week by the citizens of Philadelphia to become a permanent office. What does that tell you?
Well, you know, it told me that just under 68,000 people saw the value in what we're doing here. You know, that the work that has started long, long ago needs to continue. You know, I'm very, very honored and proud to stand on the shoulders of people who have worked before me, both in government and outside of government, to establish these lines of communication. For people who voted against the office, I certainly understand everybody has an opinion, and that only speaks to the fact that the education and the understanding of the different and varied and layered needs of the community need to be explained, that society needs to understand why something like this needs to exist. So that is certainly something looking forward that will be a continued charge for me in this office, is to truly bring to light a lot of the issues. And here I am talking about bathrooms. So this is just one very small issue.
But do you think, and if we're talking about LGBT, what all those letters mean,
correct,
that if you can explain it, people will understand it better?
Sure. You know, when you say LGBT, that's the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities. And when you're talking about lesbian and gay and bisexual, you're really talking about sexual orientation. Everybody has a sexual orientation. Everybody. Not just people who are gay or bisexual. Everybody does. That is who you are physically or romantically attracted to. Everybody's got a type, right? When you're talking about somebody who is transgender, you're talking about somebody's gender identity.
Right.
That is who they know themselves to be, male, female. So, you know, I tell, you know, usually police officers when I'm training them, it's really simple. When we're talking about sexual orientation, it's who you go to bed with. And when we're talking about gender identity, it's who you go to bed as. And everybody's got it, you know. But people who fall into the LGBT community are people who are the minority. You know, people who are attracted to the same gender or to both genders, they're the minority. The majority of the population is attracted to the opposite gender. Same thing with people who are transgender. Most people who are born with the physical and chromosomal anatomy that they identify as. Those people are cisgender, C-I-S, gender. I am cisgender. You know, my birth certificate says female, and I identify as female. People who are born with their birth certificate saying one thing and their identity being another, they're transgender. It's just that simple, and they're a minority population.
Well, thank you, Helen Fitzpatrick, for getting our conversation started on this in this hour of Radio Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Not a problem. Thanks.
You're very welcome. She's director of the Office of LGBT Affairs here in Philadelphia, and we'll be talking more about civil rights and bathrooms after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Bathrooms have played a role in the country's civil rights movement. Activists worked to integrate the whites-only bathrooms in the Jim Crow South, a symbol of segregation. Opponents of the ERA said that it would lead to unisex toilets. Last week, voters in Houston rejected an ordinance that prohibited gender identity discrimination. Critics predicted that it would lead to male pedophiles dressed as women preying on young girls in bathrooms. Their mantra was, no men in women's bathrooms. Joining us now are Jody Herman, scholar of public policy at the Williams Institute at UCLA Law School, focusing on law and policy issues related to transgender people and gender identity. Jody Herman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Terry Kogan, professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. And Terry Kogan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Terry, let me begin with you. I know you were listening in as I was talking with Helen Fitzpatrick. I'll put the same question to you. Do you see bathrooms as a civil rights issue?
There's no question. I mean, I think that the unavailability first to women in the late 19th century and early 20th century of available public facilities, and now to transgender people, relates to a basic need in human life, and therefore is definitely a civil rights issue.
This has been called, Jody, the great equalizer. You agree with that?
The great equalizer. Well, it's true that we're all human, and we all need safe access to restrooms to go about our daily lives and go to work and go to school and elsewhere in public. So, yeah, that sounds like a pretty good descriptor to me.
And Jody, you've done some research on how transgender people have experienced going to the bathroom and sometimes experiencing harassment and bullying. Tell us what your research has found.
Yes, I was interested to find out in a more systematic matter, in a more systematic way, how trans people are faring in places of public accommodation, particularly gender facilities like bathrooms or locker rooms. And so I did a survey in Washington, D.C., along with the D.C. Trans Coalition to find out more about those experiences. And we found that trans people reported having been denied access to restrooms, having been verbally harassed in restrooms, even physically assaulted. And these experiences had impacts on people's lives, including in education, employment, their physical health, and even their desire or ability to engage in public life, just generally.
Did that surprise you?
It didn't surprise me because anecdotally we've heard these types of stories for years. Pretty much every memoir, biography, or story about a trans person in a biography or autobiography, this bathroom problem continues to come up, and it continues to be expressed that these are potentially problematic spaces for trans people. So I wasn't surprised that we found that there was a problem, but I was surprised that 70% of trans people had reported experiencing one or more of those types of problems. So it's a widespread problem, it seems.
How do you see this, Terry?
I agree. I mean, I think that Jody's work on stress in public restrooms for transgender people is critically important work. Among people I know, people in Salt Lake City and elsewhere, who are transgender, a common theme is the difficulty and fear of even going into public restrooms, not knowing what will happen, not knowing whether they'll be attacked or whatever, which for many people, as I think was suggested earlier in the program, can lead to serious medical issues. Someone simply tries to hold it, and that is something we shouldn't ask of anyone.
Well, let me ask you both about this ordinance in Houston, an ordinance rejected by the voters. It would have prohibited gender identity discrimination. And what the critics said is that it would lead to pedophiles, men dressing up as women, preying on young girls in bathrooms. The idea that this would be dangerous for girls and for women to use the bathroom. Terry, what do you make of what the critics were saying and predicting if this ordinance had passed?
Well, I mean, I think this is the typical parade of horribles that has little grounding in reality, but that is used to frighten people. I think we saw it with Prop 8 in California, rejecting opportunities for marriage equality, and I think this is what we've seen in Houston. Let me share with you an experience that I had that I think belies this kind of rhetoric. So several years ago, I was in Paris at one of the wonderful museums, the Musée d'Orsay, which is the old train station turned into a museum, needed to use the restroom, walked into the basement. Lo and behold, there is an open door, that is, there's no door on it. Looked in, on one side of the room were a series of about 15 stalls with floor-to-ceiling doors. The other side of the room are a line of sinks, and men and women are walking in and out of this restroom, using their stall, going in, closing it, again, entirely enclosed by a floor-to-ceiling door, doing what they had to do, coming out, using the sinks, and leaving. And there was no suggestion of any discomfort or fear or whatever. That is to say, with appropriate security or protections, privacy protections, there is no reason that even in a multi-user stall, multi-user bathroom, which is not what the Philadelphia ordinance covers.
That's right.
Even in those bathrooms, it is possible to have all gender bathroom where none of these issues arise that the fearmongers referred to in Houston.
Terry, are you saying this is an American problem or an American issue about safety in bathrooms?
You know, I think safety in bathrooms is an issue for everyone. But to be frank, I don't think that pedophiles or whatever respect door signs. If someone is out to attack someone, they are not going to be inhibited by what the word on the door says, that the notion or, moreover, the idea that somehow molester or pedophile male would dress up like a woman just to go into a woman's bathroom is silly, just silly. I think there's no basis for it. I'm not sure it's just an American issue,
mm-hmm.
but I have a strong sense that Europe, not all of Europe, but Western Europe in particular, has come to grips with issues of gender and respect for different gender identities well before the United States has done so. I think we're moving in that direction, as evidenced by what Philly has done. But we have ways to go.
Jody, can you weigh in on this as well? And again, the critics of this Houston ordinance had this phrase that they used, or this mantra they used, was no men in women's bathrooms. And has there been any, are there cases or evidence of crimes like this happening in American bathrooms?
Well, let's just look at the policy situation elsewhere outside of Houston. There have been over 200 jurisdictions, and including 17 states and the District of Columbia, and Philly's included in those 200 jurisdictions that have enacted protections in public accommodations, which extend to restrooms. And none of these purported problems has come to pass. Washington, D.C. was one of the leaders in expanding the availability of all gender restrooms or gender neutral restrooms out of single occupancy restrooms and providing protections for trans people to use the facilities that accord with their gender identity. And none of these problems have come to pass. There was, I forget the organization that that did this little survey, but they contacted people in some of these jurisdictions that have passed these types of laws to ask law enforcement, people who sit in the agencies that govern human rights complaints, and asked, what has happened since you've passed these types of protections? And the resounding response was nothing. There has been no impact on the safety of people, women or children, in restrooms as a result of these laws. But the type of campaign that you saw in Houston is not new at all. Some people call them quote unquote bathroom panic campaigns, but they have been waged in other jurisdictions And some of the either ballot initiatives or piece of legislation that they were focused on either succeeded or failed. But the Houston campaign is nothing new, nothing new at all.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jody Herman. She's a scholar of public policy at the Williams Institute at UCLA Law School. Also with us, Terry Kogan, professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. We are talking about bathrooms as political battlegrounds, a bit about the effect that these bathrooms are having on transgender people, history of sex-segregated restrooms or bathrooms, and you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. I see comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jody, this was what I was talking with Helen Fitzpatrick about at the very beginning of the hour, what's happening here in Philadelphia. Basically, what she's saying is that the name bathroom will be on the door to a bathroom rather than coming up with gender neutral or some kind of descriptor. Does that solve the problem? And whoever wants to use the bathroom can use the bathroom and no one has to police it?
Yeah, certainly replacing a male or a female restroom sign with just restroom for single occupancy restrooms. I think that does a lot to expand the number of safe bathroom options for a variety of people. You know, so not only trans people are impacted by having, gendered restrooms, but also parents with children who need access to the changing station, which sometimes can only be in the women's room.
That's right.
People with disabilities who have assistants who are of a different gender. Women who suffer long lines while the men's room is free. That's always a pet peeve of mine. So expanding single occupancy, all gender restrooms is a good thing for everyone, I'd say.
Let me read a couple of comments from our Facebook page from Maggie. Butts are butts, bladders are bladders. Pardon my crassness, but there are bigger issues in the world than that our passion can positively affect than policing who uses the bathroom. It's 2015, and this should be a non-issue. But, Terry, it's not a non-issue.
No, it's by no means a non-issue. I mean, as we see in Houston, just to not sort of be contrarian, but just to suggest a thought with respect to the Philly ordinance, I actually think there is something to labeling one of these multi-user bathrooms all gender, because I think the phrase all gender raises an awareness in people who haven't thought about this that gender is not limited to male and female, that people identify in terms of their gender identity in many different ways. I am standing in a brand new law school, which opened several weeks ago, and we went through an extended discussion before the architects chose labels as to how we would label bathrooms. We have men's bathrooms, women's bathrooms, and then throughout the building, we have a number of bathrooms that are labeled all gender, which also are the disability accessible bathrooms. So I actually like the phrase all gender because of its educational value.
Does it have a changing table in there?
Yeah, there actually is a room across the hall on each floor which has a picture of a parent and a baby, and there's a changing table in it. And there also, interestingly, is a room for women who are breastfeeding with a very comfortable chair and a picture of a woman holding a baby. Obviously, breastfeeding is not something that's gender neutral. But the architects have tried to recognize the full range of human needs when it comes to sort of privacy and the rooms that are needed for privacy.
You know, Jody, this might be a question I would put to more a psychologist than a lawyer, but I'll put it to you anyway, because when you look at, you know, whites-only bathrooms in the Jim Crow South, you look at the ERA and the fear of unisex toilets, as the critics predicted, and then what we're talking about today, I mean, is it something about bodies and bodily functions and something about sharing that kind of space that gets people so riled up?
Yeah, that very well could be. I'm certainly not an expert in that, and I don't have a background in psychology, so my answer is limited. But I think if you look at the history of bathrooms, which Terry's work, has outlined the history of these spaces, they have been contested spaces and initially were about, having gendered restrooms at all, or restrooms for women at all, was about women entering public spaces. And, I think some of the first bathrooms that were available for women were in department stores, for instance. So it's about, I mean, there is an anxiety that type of, expansion into creating more gendered spaces was speaking to the anxiety about women's safety in public and whether or not they would be able to, you know, navigate public spaces safely. And so there were even separate, at the train station, there'd be a separate waiting area for women. So I think these spaces have always been based in this type of anxiety about safety in public for women in particular. But I'd throw it to Terry.
Sure.
To fill in that history a little bit more.
Which you have, Terry, about 45 seconds before our break. You can just get it started and then we'll finish right after the break. But yes,
okay.
You have looked at the history of women's bathrooms.
So what interested me, just as an introduction, is I wondered when I started my research, why are bathrooms separate? What led to the first separation of bathrooms in the United States? And what I discovered is that the first laws that mandated sex separation did not come about until the late 1880s. And the important thing to realize is that's not all that surprising, because the nature of public work systems and plumbing, indoor plumbing, was not at a stage until the mid-1870s in America where you could even have indoor bathrooms. Then there were privies outside, whatever. And maybe that's a good introduction.
It's a very good introduction. You just read my mind. Terry Kogan, Jody Herman joining us. Yes, we are talking about bathrooms and civil rights and some of our history as well. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and we're talking about bathrooms as political battlegrounds. Terry Kogan, professor of law at the University of Utah. Jody Herman, scholar of public policy at the Williams Institute at UCLA Law School. And we got a bunch of people that want to join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. But Terry, I want you to finish your short history of the ladies' room.
Sure. So one might assume that bathrooms were segregated because there are two sexes and people have two sets of different organs.
Plumbing.
What I discovered was that, in fact, the justification that was given for these first laws in the United States in the late 1880s looked back to what Jody referred to before as what has often been called the separate sphere ideology, that throughout the century, that was a view that women belonged in the home and only men belonged in in public places. In fact, the truth of the 19th century is that by the 1820s and 30s, women were out in public working in textile factories in the Northeast. So this ideology did not match reality. By the late 1900s, when it was finally understood that women were going to be in factories, legislators had to give up this hope of ever putting women back into these safe havens, their homes where they would watch the hearth fires and raise the kids. And what I argued that happened was that to replace this protective haven and home, the legislators passed laws that effectively created a protective haven in the workplace, a sex-segregated bathroom. Part of 19th century psychology said that women suffered from bouts of hysteria, and during those bouts, they needed a place to go and relax. And these sex-segregated spaces, in addition to protecting the weaker women who were in the workplace, would be a place they could go to suffer their bouts of hysteria.
Hmm.
The point is that the origin of the laws was based in a very sexist ideology about the relative capacity of women compared to men.
And would you say 21st century, those beliefs still linger?
Well, I think the answer is definitely yes. My current research, and without going into it, is when you look at the 20th century, you say, well, look, by First World War I, we have Rosie the Riveter, women were out in public. There was no question that women were very capable. And what you discover is that in the 1920s, there were the first uniform building codes, codes that governed how buildings were to be built for safety and health purposes. And hidden within these codes were provisions that mandated that new buildings have bathrooms segregated by sex.
Hmm.
So in other words, in the midst of what seemed to be a health safety code, this ideological historical fact was built in and carried throughout the 20th century. So that is how I think that commitment to sex separation was in an indirect way brought forward throughout the century.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have, looks like David from Doylestown joining us on Radio Times. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Another great topic on a great show.
Thank you.
I was calling to ask, and I know it's always a fool's errand to predict what courts will do, but the U.S. Department of Education has Office of Civil Rights has now filed two different findings, one in a case in Virginia and one in Chicago, regarding trans students and school bathrooms.
Right.
It seems as if the Office of Civil Rights is saying that they have the authority to do this under Title IX. But there doesn't seem to be yet any case law on this, and I'm just wondering if either of the guests have an opinion on where this might go.
Sure, David. We have two lawyers. Jody, let me toss that to you.
Full disclosure, I'm not a lawyer. I have a PhD,
oh.
Sorry.
Okay.
So I can't really comment on the law, but that's correct. There are two cases, one in Virginia and one in Illinois, regarding trans students' access to facilities at school. And the Department of Education and the Department of Justice have both weighed in, saying that, you know, that trans students may be covered under sex discrimination protections under Title IX. If Terry wants to weigh in as a lawyer, I will defer at this point. But I will say that Title IX and Title VII, which governs employment, the federal agencies have and the EEOC have said that discrimination against trans people can be considered unlawful sex discrimination under Title IX or Title VII, rather. So I do think we might be charting a trajectory in that direction. Terry?
Sure. Terry, go ahead.
I also have no crystal ball as to where this will go, but I think Jody has pointed out the important trajectory, which is that the concept of sex under Title VII and Title IX has been steadily growing to include gender identity. And accordingly, it looks like that's the direction of the law. Of course, the question becomes, the difficult question, is whether even if one's gender identity is protected, there might be some requirements of some kind of accommodations based on issues like privacy. And that's why these cases, I think, raise such difficult issues. If I understand correctly, I think the Chicago case involves not just restroom facilities, but locker rooms.
Huh.
And those are the most difficult issues of all. Having said that, I mean, I think, as I'm sure Jody's research would support, trans people care as much or more about privacy issues as anyone else does. That is to say, we're not in a world where if locker rooms become open to people based on their gender identity, we're going to have people, sort of trans people, going into them sort of to flaunt who they are. I think that's a ridiculous vision. I think the issue underlying this is to make sure that all of our concerns about privacy are protected, in whether it be a public restroom or a public locker room.
Let me get David. Thanks for the call. Let's see what Robert from Allentown has to say. Robert, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
We own a couple of restaurants in a few jurisdictions, and we're in the process of opening one up in Allentown. It's in an old historic building, and we had three single stall restrooms, which we labeled as gender neutral because, for a variety of reasons, we thought it made sense. And the city actually came in, and it's in the plumbing code in one place and the health code in another place. So we had to change it to one men's, one women, and one we were allowed to keep gender neutral. So I think we may just need statewide legislation, because these requirements, even when you have a business owner that I'm really eager to have gender neutral restrooms, it's the technicalities in these different codes. And I don't think there was any particular animus by the building inspectors. But, you know, there it is. I just had to go today and buy the new signs.
Well, you know, I'm really glad you raised that, Robert, because this is something, Terry, you have written about. And this is the Uniform Plumbing Code, that in certain ways is a driver of what people like Robert can do.
I think that's exactly right. I think Robert's example, Robert's story is a terrific example of how in these unwitting ways the law perpetuates traditional visions of gender, perpetuates the understanding that it's irrelevant what gender identity you happen to have in using a bathroom, that somehow there are men, there are women, and there are others. And I think that is a terribly problematic thing for the law to be teaching in these indirect ways. That men, we have men with all kinds of gender identities, but who still call themselves men, same with women, and same with transgender people. It is not like there are three categories in this world. The range of gender identities, the way we understand ourselves and present ourselves in public, is a rich tapestry. And it seems to me that a law like this perpetuates a rigid vision of who we are as people.
Let me read a couple of emails. One from Joya says, my 14-year-old daughter proudly displays her I'll go with her button that was distributed at her Gay Straight Alliance meeting. I asked her what it meant. She said that she and her friends will go to the bathroom with any transgender student who needs a buddy. Her generation has it figured out. An email from Janet. I live in Delaware. Many public places I visit have at least one bathroom labeled for men and women, often plus handicapped, all in one. I think this is a good solution. I see no need for further definitions, as she calls it. And then we do have some emails, Jody, basically saying, what the heck are you talking about? Why are we talking about bathrooms in 2015?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that it is kind of interesting that this conversation does continue to come up over history in our country. It speaks to how salient an issue it is for people and how we navigate our daily lives, and the ability to tap into certain anxieties around these spaces in order to make political statements. So, yes, it's kind of ubiquitous. And surprisingly so for some folks.
Yeah. Well, and it's one of the reasons one of the several reasons we wanted to do this program. Let me get, it looks like Terry from Hatboro to join us. Hi, Terry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, nice, glad to be here.
Yes, you are?
My mother has passed away, but she had incontinence problems and she had walking problems. I had to roll her into a handicapped bathroom, which very often was not big enough to have all three of us in there, the chair, her, and I. So the door oftentimes had to be open. I would be horrified to think that there was a man in the neighborhood. And there's some of these things are just not, are gender specific. For instance, another situation, I'm a woman, you have periods, and every so often when you get soiled, you have to wash them, your underwear out before you can continue on. And some of these things like this, I don't know what I would do if I had to be expected to be so gender neutral that wouldn't bother me. And I think a lot of women would. And could you address that,
sure,
please?
No, Terry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jody, can I toss that back to you?
Sure. So I think the caller brings up a good point that there are a lot of situations wherein people in public would prefer to have extra privacy. And so I don't think that making sure that people have the privacy that they need in public spaces is in any way, contradictory to the things that Terry and I are talking about today. I think that those types of spaces can be created and maintained, and we can also accommodate people with disabilities and transgender people and people with kids. I think that it's perhaps just a lack of imagination on our part as to how we're designing buildings. Sounds like Terry's building might be the building of the future in that regard, because they've thought of a lot of these particular things. But I don't think that that's in conflict with anything that we're talking about today.
Terry, you want to weigh in on that at all?
Well, sure. I mean, this is lovely that we have sort of a gender neutral name, Terry,
yes.
I'm a man. And I also have an elderly mother who's in a wheelchair who I also have to deal with in public bathrooms. But in this case, it's a son taking a mother into a public restroom, and gender is the least of my concerns. What's important, of course, about the Philly ordinance is it deals only with single-user bathrooms.
That's right.
So the concerns that Terry raises about privacy are fully respected by the Philly ordinance, and that's very important. When we move to the next step, if we do, where we have more unisex bathrooms, one may well need other considerations that protect privacy, like the ones I spoke about earlier. And even if we have unisex bathrooms at some point in the future, I think it's critical that we have a separate space, a separate single-user bathroom in which all of these privacy concerns can be met by those who need them. People who have disabled people who have special needs, breastfeeding mothers, parents who need to change children. That is to say, even with unisex bathrooms, we still need a private, separate bathroom to deal with all of these needs.
And we're almost out of time here. Just an email from Mary I want to read. She says, I'm a woman who has worked in construction for 30 years. Many times the only bathrooms available are job site porta-johns. These are used by everyone. They are not gender labeled. The only issue I have with these is the adolescent male graffiti inscribed on the walls by adult males. So, you know, Jody, we live in a complicated world, right?
That's true, and it's too bad that she has to suffer the graffiti. But that actually harkens back to women over the years moving into more traditionally male dominated industries and the lack of bathrooms available for women in those spaces. So it sounds like that trend has continued in some regards.
And certainly here in Philadelphia. Well, my thanks to both of you. We are out of time. And interestingly, we weren't sure how many calls we were going to get. We have lots of calls talking about bathrooms and political battlegrounds. Jody Herman, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's a scholar of public policy, not a lawyer, at the Williams Institute at UCLA Law School. Terry Kogan, thank you very much as well.
It was a pleasure to be here.
And he's a professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. And we began our conversation with Helen Fitzpatrick, director of LGBT affairs for the city of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Thanks for those phone calls, and do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.